C1PR. Number 8A.
We come to the third subject, which I tried this time to epitomize as the prayer of reformation through sinlessness, through Christ's selfhood. How do we get to the third subject? We only get to the first subject through the first and second. We just can't get it another way. We always have to start with the right basis if we want to build safely. And the right basis says, look out for God as He is. That's the basis of prayer. He goes and says, well, don't leave it at that, or it's far away. Take it near, reflect it. How can you reflect it? By taking it to us, near to us. And so we come to the second prayer of reflection by worshipping the first basis, the first prayer. In the second prayer, we worship that which we have seen in the first prayer. And as we worship that which we have seen in the first prayer, and it becomes nearer and nearer to us, more tangible to us, more real to us, it becomes more us, and so it reforms us. We are no more the old us, but the new us. It has a reforming effect on us. And this third subject tells us about this reformation. It starts right in that sorrow for wrongdoing is only the first step, that the next step is reformation. Well, so many people like to be reformed. They long to be reformed. They are so fed up with themselves that they like to be reformed. But you see so clearly now that if we would start with the third subject, with reformation, because we feel we have to be reformed, but how could we do it if we would start with that law? We would try it. We would try it in the best human way we can. But we would never succeed. Because the first subject and the second subject is lacking. If we would start with the third, we would have no basis, no true object to where we would go. And we would have no inward fertile ground in which this seed can be sown, so that something new can blossom out. So that the order is so irresistible that we can see all those nice and wonderful efforts that are being made by people to reform are all in vain unless we have not grown through the first prayer and the second prayer, and we see that the second prayer really lifts us into the third of reformation. Is that clear? Well, that's something that 1, 2, 3, that 1, 2, 3, that 1, 2, 3, that goes right all the way through this first big chapter is fundamental. That is so big and so wonderful that we just can't say, well, I have studied that once. Now what next? It stays with us, it's so big with us, that if ever we start somewhere, we have to start with the basis. We have to worship that basis. And as we worship that basis becomes nearer to us, more tangible to us, more real to us, and we are another us, a new us, a reformed us. Here, it is quite nicely shown. The end of the third subject has foreshadows what has to come. In the subtone of spirits of truth, she has already said, well, the good you worship and the good you do and the good you are will be evil spoken of. Patience must have experience. Patience must have experience. Apparently, she wants to say that this second tries and tries to see, is it genuine? It says in the next subtone of spiritual love, whatever materializes where she keeps us from demonstrating our power over error. That if that worship is not genuine and not genuine and has a touch of material worship, it will never resurrect us. It will never lift us above error. And so she comes right in with the beginning of the third big subject of song, says, well, that worship must be tested if it's genuine. If it has the integrity and the genuineness of soul. The integrity of soul which knows but one thing. Reading this third subject through over and over and over, listening to what new tone she is bringing in, we can't fail noticing the true tone. It is so different. Suddenly we find terms which we have not encountered before. Like sin. Sin. She uses sin I don't know how many times. Diabolism. Devil. Satan. Offense. The works of the devil. Evil works. Wrongdoing. The work badly done or undone. The seal are not according to knowledge. Suddenly get that sense. Oh, there is something at work against me. There is something going wrong. See, up to this point, you left the tares and the wheat. You are not considering the tares. You are considering what are the wheat, how I'm going to love the wheat, how I'm going to grow the wheat, how I'm going to nurture the wheat. And now, little by little, we come to the third, where the wheat is gathered into the barn, and the tares are burnt. That's so. Here we get that. We get that thing which says, now, what about this thing called sin, devil, wrongdoing? Can you drag that along and along and along as long as we like or not? And so the third subject says no. Says no. Now we have to make up our minds. We are only in prayer, so it's only the making up of our minds. Are we going to burn the tares or not? Are we going in the line of sinlessness, or are we satisfied with the first and second day and try to evade the third day, try to evade to get rid of evil, of sin? And we know, unless we go to the third day, the children of two and yonder are not secure. Only as in our mentality that third day grows and grows, there comes a sense of security on us, in us. So, you may think it over and say, well, what is this tone in here? Always about sin and sin and human sin and devil and so on. What about it? And then suddenly, on the other side, one encounters new terms which one hasn't encountered before. Christ, Christian sentiment. And suddenly you feel, oh, that's the point. It is a question where the Christ comes in and says, well, sin has to be abolished. The rule of soul seems to pervade this third subject. The rule of soul which says, what is the rule? The rule which always says, I reproduce and reproduce and reproduce. What? The rule of soul says always, if I am faced with any sin, diabolism, or what it is, what is my rule? How can I rule out the situation? I can't rule it out in another way than go back to my basis in mind and to worship that basis in spirit. And as I do that, going back to mind, worshipping that which I understand in mind, sticking to that which I worship in mind, I build up in consciousness that firm, ground, a solid ground of the third day, which can no more be tempted. It's the Christ selfhood. Here, as I said, she speaks a lot about sin. But what is sin? We always should read the textbook from time to time with the mentality where we say, now, if I would not know anything about this textbook and would have only read as far as I have come now, those first few pages, what would I know about it? Here she suddenly comes in with sin and sin and sin. But she doesn't define sin as she does, say, in the glossary or so. She doesn't give a definition of sin. She just says sin, and we have that sin brings suffering, and that we have to discard sin and so on. But what is sin? Well, here again, I think one has to see the gentleness of her writing. In the marginal heading, she speaks of human sin. Of human sin. So apparently, she doesn't speak of the deep meaning of sin. You know, as she says in retrospection, that sin existed as a false claim before the human concept of sin was formed. Well, that's the root sin here, which existed before the human concept of it was formed. But here she speaks about the human sin. So it must be that first touch of sin, which tries to tempt us not to go the way. And to my sense, you may challenge me, but to my sense, viewed from its science, here sin can mean nothing else but not be willing to go the way to the first and second subject. That's what she has presented, and that's what she has given to the reader and said, but if you don't want to take that, then you miss the mark. That's your sin. It's your human sin. It's your sin. It's not sin in its essence as that which existed before the human concept of it was formed. She must write gentle to the reader and say, well, that's really the first thing you have to master. And that's the very first thing you can master. Namely, that you don't want to go the rule of soul. You don't want to start with mind, with the prayer of mind, and take God as he is. That's your sin. You don't want afterwards to worship that God as he is. If you don't want to worship that, that's your human sin. You miss the mark. That's my interpretation. It isn't in the textbook. So take it for what it is. But somehow we must see a reason how she can come and deal with sin without defining sin. Well, she has defined sin to a spiritual sense. Namely, she has defined sin that it is missing the mark, missing to do what the first subject tells us to do, missing to do what the second subject tells us to do. That's our first human sin. And that, I feel, where we have to start to handle sin. It isn't starting with all sorts of funny concepts of sin, not doing this and not doing that anymore, to which one hasn't grown up to. But this is a sin to which one now has grown up to, and which one with right can ask of the reader now, please, will you go on in the right way, or don't you want to go on in the right way? To me, it's satisfying very much, because one can see how people struggle against what they call sins. And they start at the end. They start with so-called sins which they have termed, or which morals or theology has termed sins. And they have a hell of a fight with it. Well, that is not unfoldment, to have a hell of a fight and not succeed, after all. They never succeed. But here is something, the first touch of sin, which says, now, I have given you the first big pillar. Now comes the testing stone of your sincerity. If you can go with a 3.5, well, you are off. That's fine. But here's the testing. Do you know the rule of soul? Do you rule the rule of soul? And about it, and you go back and say, well, here is the situation, I think I have to pray about it. What are we going to pray about? The prayer says, well, there is nothing to pray about other than first to get the right basis, and that's the right concept of God. And asking ourselves now, do I devote my thought, my life to that God? Then secondly, it says now, do I love that God? Do I want that God? I'm willing to worship that God, or do I want something else? And so it comes to the second subject of that worship. That's our rule. Then the third subject comes and says, now, if you keep that rule, you're sinless. The rule is sinless. If you don't want to keep that rule, it's sin. It's human sin. So, here she takes us and says, now listen, she says, what we sow, we reap. Sin brings suffering. We can't fight with it. She presents the law of sin. Then, presenting the law of sin, she says, now, do you want to serve sin or not? Do we want to use the rule of soul or not? If we want to use the rule of soul, well, then we reap what we sow, and that's what we sow was good, and so we reap blessings. We get the full award. But, she says, the third subject says, you can't fool yourself. You can't fool God, you can't fool yourself. You can't speculate with that God. You can't speculate with metaphysics. It must be a straight, forward, sincere attitude. Because there is deep seated in metaphysics a law which says, if you sin, it brings suffering. It says, if you use the rule, it's sinless, and you get a full award. See, the third subject is a testing stone. It's that which comes after the second, after our love, and tests our love, and says, now, are you sincere about it? Or are you just going to fool yourself in your heart? Are you just making up something in your heart? Now, give the test of sincerity. And so, we come to the subject. How she tests, or says, how we can test our sincerity. She says, if you are sincere, I mean, in principle, she says, she says in this third subject, if you are sincere, it does reform us. If you are sincere, we fulfill the third day of creation, and that means that the first and second day does reform us, brings reformation, brings a new birth, which brings forth a reformed being. So let us glance through these stones, always having in view that sense of reformation and in view that we can't fool ourselves. I just long for the next Saturday, the Saturday of the next talk, because we can go through these sub-tones from many different angles, and I have made notes which are four times bigger than what I tell you, but I can see that first we have to ponder these stones for during these weeks and ponder them so that we afterwards just can play on them, and then we can take these aspects like rule and just see how through all the sub-tones she gives us the rule of soul. We can take aspects like the trend in our mentality which says, but can't I back out? And show how in different seven ways we try to back out, not to go, to use the rule. And so there are many, many aspects to these simple few pages which just pervade every sub-tone, and which just gives us then a very, very tangible picture of what this third day really means. So, I heartily desire, really, you know, sure, I think we just kind of wallow in it, you know. And it becomes really big. Those simple tones are big. They are not complicated. They are big, but not complicated. Well, here it is. Where to start? It says, where shall I start? Well, she says, Reformation begins with learning that there is no discount in the law of justice. Our first, you see, we still are in prayer where we approach God. So first we have to be clear and learn where we say, that rule of soul is sinless. I can't back it out. I can't back out. There is no discount in the law. A law is a law, the law remains a law, that's the rule of the law. That law is law, remains law, is always law, sticks to law, and so on. That's the rule of the law. I can't back out. There is no discount. And I just fool myself if I think, well, God Almighty will have a weak hour and just forgive me for once. Well, that's the Lord Almighty with a beard. But it's the moment we think scientifically, we just laugh at such a religious thought. That two times two, once a while, can say, all right, let's have it five. Doesn't matter. No. That's why we, you see, we are not yet really out of the religious thought. All these things will be so clear, so natural. So, all right, there is the test. The first test for us is, are we willing to learn that there is no backing out? There is no discount in the law of justice. We have to pay the full price. What we put in it, we'll get back. And it will be full and running over. And the measure we meet shall be measured to you again, and it will be full and running over. That's the law. What I put into these signs, I get back. You see how this comes so gently after the second big subject of loving. Comes so and says, you know, I give you now the certainty and the security of this whole thing. If you love that genuinely, well, here comes the rule of mind. The rule of mind, the rule of mind, the rule of the law of justice, which says, you can be sure. You get it full and running over. But in both ways. If I sidestep it, I get it full and running over too. Then we go to the second subtone, which shows us that reformatory steps ensure a final full award. Now, the Spirit always is that which gives the blessing, the award, which reflects itself. Always that which gives the fruit. And the question is, well, will I get the right award if I stick to the rule of soul? If I do that, what we have heard in the first subject and in the second subject, do I really get an award for that? Because something in me says, I wonder. Because I look around in the world and see those sinners, how they flourish. They just flourish. They just have everything. The money just pours into their pockets. They seem to have everything. They seem to get much further than we do. And so the question is, has it fruit? Has this rule, this sinlessness of our attitude, this rule of soul, will it have its fruit? You get the tone of spirit. And she says, oh yeah, you get the fruit. Sinners and saints get their fruit. But how? She said, be careful. She said, the sinners, they flourish like a green bay tree. But the psalmist could see their end. Apparently there is an end to that flourishing. Yeah. And that's what soul does to material worship. That's the law of soul to material worship, that it says, I put an end on it. It dies out. The positive rule of soul or spirit here says, saints get their award. But how? She says, they get it not in worldly riches, but it pours the riches of his love into their understanding. That blessing is of the nature of spirit. How on earth are we going to expect from spirit a blessing which is contrary, different from spirit? That we must be pure in our attitude and expect from spirit spiritual riches. And she says another point of spirit, she says, but spirit gives it according to our day. That Spirit doesn't give you the pool of water next day because, that she doesn't say, but we know, because we couldn't take it. We couldn't take it. We can only take the blessing according to our understanding. Because already in mind as life, she has said, well, what are you looking for? You are, life is pouring forth more than what you accept. That's the truth about it. That life is pouring out the riches now, hasn't it? But the question is, why are we ready to receive it? And Joseph says, well, you receive your reward according to your day, according to your enlightenment, according to your widening out of your womb. If you are narrow and little, well, how can you have infinite blessings? It drops beside. So, you see how Spirit here is really exemplified through the second day of creation here, as that gentle unfoldment, that Spirit purely feeds and clothes every object in the line of spiritual creation. In the measure as our thought opens and opens, we have the blessing, we have the award. So, she gives here the certainty of the award, but explains that this certainty of the award must be properly realized and understood. That it is a word which is spiritual and not material, and that it is a word which comes in its fullness with the fullness of days, in that measure. And that it can't come in a bigger way than what we receive. I can have a big bucket full of water, but if I have only a teaspoon, well, I just can lap a little bit. But I could have the whole bucket of water. That's what she wants to say here. Then she goes to soul, a soul, to the subtone of soul, which I tried to epitomize and say the destruction of sin by Christ is the sole means for reformation. It's the sole means of reformation. In other words, there is no substitute for the Christ selfhood. There is no substitute for the rule of soul. That's what she wants to say. The rule of soul, soul of soul, says, I'm sinless, that's my Christ selfhood. That's the only way to deal with sin, to deal with temptation. To deal with temptation, I can only, not through morals, not through goodwill, but only through my Christ selfhood. And there is no backing out through a substitute. There is no substitute. If I deny Christ, he denies me, she says. There is no backing out. Soul always says to us, you have to face things. Soul says, you have to face things as they are. You have to identify them as they are. Says, sin brings inescapable penalty. That's the big rule of soul. The sinlessness of soul is such that it brings to sin penalty. So sin and penalty really are identical. And for this penalty, for this rule, there is no backing out. Religion tries to back it out, what it says, through confession. It says confession can't cancel sin. Can't cancel it. There is no substitute. Always in soul, when we go through the chapters, very far in the textbook, very often when you come to soul, it's always a sense you can't substitute it with something else. You have to take the identical rule, the identical measure. Here, the substitute is prayer. I mean the theological sense of prayer. Where we say, all right, I have sinned, but please forgive me, and if you are good Lord Almighty, you will forgive me, and if you ask me to say 10 prayers, I will pray 10 prayers and so on, then I hope you will forgive me. Says, oh no, sin is sinless. Sinlessness is sinlessness. And there is no other way to sinlessness than through sinlessness. There is no substitute to it, no backing out. Oh, I always get in the third subject the sense there's no backing out. You have to face it. You have to go through it. You have to stick to the rule of soul through thick and thin. So we see here again those reformatory means. That how is Reformation here being brought about? Then, well, Reformation is brought about through sinlessness. If we desire sinlessness, we can only attain it through its identical means and nature, namely through a sinless selfhood, and not through any other means. Then we come to principle, the subtone of principle, where the question of pardon is brought up. Is there a backing out of sin through pardon? That God pardons it. She says, no, there is no backing out of pardon. All that you can do in order to get your divine pardon is through improving God's talents which you have. Improving God's talents reforms, and that is the only pardon. So again, in principle, you see, always when you come to the subtone of principle, it is that sense you have to keep the commandment. You have to stick to principle. One has to have a principled attitude. And we can't substitute the principled attitude by anything else. So, soul says as principle, soul wants to reform us into a principled idea. And principle is here put in contradiction to person. Says God's pardon is what? The destruction of sin. That's God's pardon, the destruction of sin. That's his way. Whereas people's pardon, men's pardon, priests' pardon, is that they pardon without destroying the sin. But then she says, what happens? You fall back. There is no pardon without, no real pardon. If sin is not destroyed, we always can go back and repeat the offense. So, here in principle, says, the only way of reformation is not through pardon, through human pardon, through personal pardon. It is only through that divine pardon which means destruction of sin. But how can we destroy sin? That's always the question here in the third big subject. It says, all right, here, by improving God's talent. See, again, she says, it isn't something highly metaphysical. It is that what you have. She appeals in this first chapter always to that which we have already. That's the comfort of this chapter. She doesn't ask something which we don't yet have. She doesn't ask to use something to which we have not yet grown to. The tenderness of the first chapter is that she uses all that which an ordinary, earnest seeker here on this globe has. And that's why these chapters bridge, really, the human with the divine. So here she says, what you can do is to correct it. And this correction is only through improving God's talent. She says, God is not separate from the wisdom he bestows. There is that wonderful unity of God and the wisdom and his talents he bestows. There is that, we seldom think of this mighty big tone. That principle, we say principle idea is one. You know principle idea is one. Yeah. That's high metaphysics. And then we bring it down to the beginner where we are. We have it here. She says, well, God is not separate from the wisdom he bestows. He is not separate from the talents he has given. What are our talents which we have? Well, then we begin to look inward and say, what do I know already of God? And that little bit I know already of God is God's dish, is God-like, has God's qualities, has already in itself, that little seed has already in itself all the qualities of God. My word, we say, what I'm looking in the far, why don't I look in me? Why don't I have an introspective view and say, well, that little seeking which I have, that has already the authority of principle. That's already the authority of principle. That little love I already have for the divine, that has in itself already the authority of prince, because the wisdom is not separate from the principle, from God. The talent he gives, she says here, we must improve. We must make use to our advantage. That's the definition of improve, to use to advantage. We must use to advantage that little bit which we have learned today in the first few pages. Well, because why should we use that? Is that big? Yes, she says, it's principles. That little bit of God which we have seen, that little seed, even if it's the smallest among the seeds, that is principled. It is not just practically nothing. It is principled. When we think in terms of God and of God's idea, we have no quantity of idea. We have quality of idea. And so really, we should begin, you see, that's the reformation in us. The reformation in us here of soul, the rule of soul, as principle says, I beg you, make advantage of what you already have in you, because that little bit which you already have in you is one with God. It's not separate from the God. It has all the qualities of God already in itself. Let it unfold. Love it. Nurture it. Keep it pure. Keep it secure. Keep it sinless. But it has in itself already all the qualities of God. How on earth can a quality of God be separate from the wholeness of God? I wonder why. How? Is God up there and the quality of down here? See, that's the way of reformation. It's not trying humanly to do something, trying to be good, trying to be mighty good and so on. No. She said, use the rule I have shown you in the first subject and in the second subject, and then it begins to reform you. It begins to reform you. How? Well, you make up your mind, all right, there is no backing out. There is no loaf discount. So I better go into it. I really am better, I'm sincere about it. Then the second subtone says, yes, and you know, that reformation is going on and on. Don't worry that you don't get your award. That reformation is going on according to your day, according to your love, according to your vision, according how you love it and take it in, and according how you open your mind and your womb. That's going on, and you get your reward and your fruit. Don't be worried, that's a definite rule. And then it comes on, something says to me, oh yes, all right. Then I'm not trying another way. Then I'm not going to look out for a substitute. Then I go the sinless way. And so I don't try a substitute, like audible prayer and so on. I go through. Well, then comes principle and says, all right, so use what you have in you. Improve your talent, because those little seeds are not separate from the mighty principle. They are backed up by the principle. Therefore, they have all the authority of principle in you. Then you cannot fall back and repeat the offense. You become principle. And the minute we become principle, she calls on to life and says, all right, if you are principle, well, that's fine. Then every. And it comes to every supposed pleasure in sin and so on will have to be destroyed. And you come to the individuality of it. So, have you the root? All right, you begin to become safe. Have you the root? Become principled in our rule and in using our rule. Well, that gives you the answer to every sin and every pleasure of sin. Everyone. Now you get the many.